from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's opening forum hour, a team of astronomers on Monday released what's being called a monumental discovery about the origins of the universe. Using telescopes at the South Pole, scientists discovered gravitational waves they say prove that the universe expanded rapidly, less than a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang. Scientists are calling the discovery a smoking gun evidence of a theory known as inflation that experts have been trying to prove for 35 years. We'll look at the discovery and its significance for science, cosmology, and our understanding of the universe after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. In what is being hailed as one of the most extraordinary cosmology discoveries in decades, scientific researchers announced on Monday a major Big Bang breakthrough with results indicating gravitational waves a sliver of a second after the Big Bang. This would appear to support physicist Alan Guth's controversial inflation theory put forward back in the 80s that the universe is indeed expanding. It may, if corroborated fully, also serve to bring relativity and quantum mechanics together. And in this morning's opening forum hour, we discuss these new findings and what they mean and what they portend. Joining us in studio is Andrew Fracknoy, chair of the astronomy program at Foothill College. Andy Fracknoy, good to have you back on forum.
Welcome. Nice to be with you.
We also have Brian Green with us this morning, professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia, author of The Hidden Reality, Parallel Universes and the Deep Laws of the Cosmos, and The Elegant Universe. He's co-founder of the World Science Festival and World Science U, and good to have you back, Brian Green. Welcome.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Also with us this morning from Stanford is Leonard Susskind, Felix Bloch professor of physics and author of a new book called The New Book of Quantum Mechanics. It's actually called Quantum Mechanics, and he's professor of physics at Stanford. Welcome back, Leonard Susskind. Good to have you.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Okay, and thank you for joining us. We also have another Stanford guest, and that's Chao-Lin Kuo, and he's assistant physics professor at Stanford, part of the team that made the discovery. And let me welcome you, Chao-Lin Kuo, and congratulate you.
Thank you.
Glad to have you aboard. And let me begin, actually, by getting some background from you on this discovery and really what it means. And we're talking about, let's first of all talk about that video that went viral. You went into Andre Linde's home, I guess, and said, look, this is a guy who for years had supported, in fact, is known as one of the founding fathers of the inflation theory. Let him know what the results of this were. And there was champagne and there was hyperventilating and he was ready to go off on a trip to the Caribbean. This is pretty exciting.
Yes. Yes. So the most frequently asked question was this staged? And the answer is absolutely not. Everything in there was real.
Well, what is also real, apparently, are these results. You were one of the four leaders of this BICEP 2. This went on for actually data covering over 3 years. And what you found is pretty amazing. Let's talk about that. These swirly so-called B-mode patterns, which are the unique signature of gravitational waves.
Yes. So what we're doing is, so we are absolutely relying on three important theoretical foundations. One is how inflation works, how does inflation generate gravitational waves, and how do gravitational waves generate B-mode polarization. But we, as experimentalists, we just go out and measure this B-mode polarization as a function of position. And we think we found it.
Well, this, we should mention, was done with a telescope up in the South Pole. And
that's
the South Pole allows you to get these faint microwaves from the Big Bang because it's pretty clear, it's dry, and it's about as close as you can get to space and still be on the ground.
Yes, absolutely.
So,
because water vapor absorbs microwave and re-emit a microwave.
So these are waves we're talking about, but waves that go back almost 14 billion years.
Depending on which wave you're referring to. So we're looking at the cosmic microwave background, which was emitted at when the universe was 400,000 years old. But on it, there's an imprint of gravitational wave, we believe. And that gravitational wave came from much earlier epoch, 10 to minus 35 seconds after the Big Bang.
Pretty exciting stuff. I mean, it is monumental, isn't it?
Well, we like to believe it. Yeah, we are all excited about it.
Well, there are going to be, in fact, more, I suppose, corroboration. There are more tests being done, more teams taking up and measuring this. But what does it mean to you to have made this discovery?
I think it's an incredible combination of, I think, theoretical guidance, incredible technology, and just faith as well. Because as experimentalists, especially, you know, it's pretty easy to get cynical because, you know, these theories and theorists, they're incredibly smart and they just come up with theories after theories. So you have to pick the right ones to believe. And because you're going to spend the next 10 or even more years looking for this signal, and we just got very, very lucky.
Andre Linde and Alan Guth must feel pretty happy, especially Alan Guth after 35 years. Were you surprised by the strength of the signal?
We were a little bit surprised. A little bit was just psychological because there hasn't been any major physics discoveries for a long time, and we're all in this search mindset, trying to set better and better upper limits. So, initially we were definitely surprised by how strong the signal is. Don't get me wrong, this is an incredibly faint signal. The degree of polarization is one part in 30 million. But, you know, we have very, very capable, very, very sensitive instruments, and we can easily detect that signal. So we have a very, very significant detection of something, and that something looks just like what the inflationary theory predicts.
And Xiaolin Kuo, again, is with us by phone, assistant physics professor at Stanford, part of the team that made the discovery, and the discovery is of these ripples of space-time waves that are described as the first tremors of the Big Bang following the Big Bang. Thank you so much for being with us, and again, congratulations to you.
Thank you.
Let me bring Andy Fracknoy into this, who is an astronomer of great note here in the Bay Area and, in fact, is professor of astronomy and head of the program over at Foothill College. Fingerprints of inflation, what does that mean, Andy?
Well, so to set the background for our listeners, what this experiment is all about, looking at the afterglow of the Big Bang, just like when you have an explosion or a giant flash bulb going off here on Earth, it leaves an afterglow. The same way the flash of the Big Bang has left an afterglow which is spread out throughout the universe. It started out as very intense and energetic radiation, but as all the galaxies expanded and the universe got bigger and colder, this afterglow is now radio waves, microwaves of the kind that you use in your microwave oven. And these microwaves from the beginning of time are there as a kind of signal from the Big Bang. And what this group has done is they've taken this amazing background radiation, this leftover energy from the Big Bang, and searched inside it for telltale imprints of an even earlier time, of a time not 400,000 years after the Big Bang, but less than a second after the Big Bang. I mean, let's stop and think how astounding it is that with our instruments, we can now probe back to a fraction of a second before the Big Bang. We believe, and that's the theories that you guys were talking about, we believe that at the very earliest moments, there was this period where the universe really grew. It grew tremendously. That's called the period of inflation. And if that period of inflation took place, then in the waves from the Big Bang, there might be this unbelievably subtle imprint of that inflationary epoch. And it shows up as a kind of polarization, as a kind of change in the ripples of space-time, as you say. Very difficult to detect. People did not think that we had the equipment yet to detect it. Yet through patience and an enormous amount of work massaging the data, this group, this collaboration of many different physics and astronomy groups has found this tiny ripple that indicates the beginning of time may be like our theories. It may have had a period of great blow-up at the very, very start.
Well, that great, in fact, let me get sort of your perspective as an astronomer, because that great blow-up was referred to by a whole team of astronomers led by John Kovac out of Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. And I was reading the New York Times. They said the detection of these gravitational waves, quote, are a signature of the universe being violent, wrenched apart when it was roughly a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. I mean, you can't even get your mind around that, obviously. Also, talk about the telescope. I mean, because the technology here in the telescope is central. BICEP-2, as it's called, what does that stand for? Background Imaging of Cosmic Extragalactal Polarization.
Extragalactic polarization. You are good. Yes, you got it just right.
But it's compared to a giant kind of superconducting thermometer.
That's right. What we're measuring is the leftover energy from the Big Bang, and it's quite cold now. That's why they had to go to the South Pole, because they want to detect radiation that doesn't get so easily through the Earth's atmosphere, except where it's really dry. He mentioned that these microwaves are absorbed by water and other things in our atmosphere. So they had to go to a dry place, to a place where their very, very sensitive detectors could pick up unbelievably faint signals within these microwaves from the beginning of time.
Again, Andrew Fracknoy here in studio is chair of the astronomy program at Foothill College. Leonard Susskind is Felix Bloch Professor of Physics at Stanford. Leonard Susskind, and author of a new book called Quantum Mechanics. I'm also reading, and maybe you can make this understandable for the lay audience, Leonard, about how this may lead to an actual union between quantum mechanics and relativity.
Yes, that, well, lead to it might be an extreme statement, but confirming it, yeah. These waves, these things that people are talking about, they're gravitational waves, but that means they're gravitons. Gravitons are the particles that that are supposed to carry the quantum mechanics of gravity, and they're the same kind of gravitons that would be produced by black holes. They're the same kind of gravitons that we call Hawking radiation. They're not just standard gravitation. They're gravitation together with quantum mechanics. And we really never had the idea that we might even be able to detect anything like a graviton. What's going on here is really at the center of modern speculation about how gravity, quantum mechanics, cosmology, the whole works, how it all fits together.
This is, as they say, this is the whole enchilada.
This is the whole enchilada. I'm not a person of superlatives. I rarely use them, and I don't like hype. But boy, this is a big one.
Well, what does it mean to confirm inflation theory? I mean, these are, I know, like fossils of inflationary cosmology that come to us through these gravitational ripples. Why is this so important?
Well, first of all, it does confirm inflation. It not only confirms inflation, it says that the inflation was stronger than we previously expected. The explosive force of it, the rate at which it took place, is faster. And because it's faster, it can create these gravitational ripples. So, number one, it confirms inflation. That's enormously important if you're a cosmologist. Number two, it confirms or helps us understand the connection between gravity and quantum mechanics. That's an enormously important thing if you're interested in theoretical physics and how gravity and quantum mechanics fit together. There are, in fact, what I would say is, you know, there's a culture of people out there that don't really believe in mixing quantum mechanics and gravity together. Freeman Dyson is one of them. He speculated that gravitons don't even really exist. I think those people, if they're not going to have to eat their words, at least they're going to have to nibble at them a little bit now.
Can we theorize about an event taking place before inflation? Wouldn't that be the next thing to find?
Okay, this is something else that's in the data. Nobody's mentioned it yet, but it's in the data that there's a little bit of a glitch. It doesn't exactly work the way the average vanilla inflationary theory works. There's something a little bit anomalous. It's called the low L anomaly. And what it has to do with is the signals from the very, very earliest time, even before inflation started, just at the very, very onset of inflation. We didn't know if we could see the onset of inflation. There's a little bit of a glitch. The signal is too weak. There's something going on in that data that's sort of not so easy to see. And what it's suggesting, just it's a vague suggestion, but what it's suggesting is that there was an event that took place even before inflation, even before this trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. What that event was, at the moment, it looks entirely consistent that it might be what we call a bubble nucleation, the creation of the universe out of a multiverse. We don't know. We can't tell. That may be stretching a point a little bit too far.
Yeah, but I think, aren't you on record as saying you give up half your salary to see that?
Well, I would give up half my salary. Look, you have to ask my wife if that's okay. But, yeah, I would give up a lot. There's one more thing that has to be detected in order to really nail that down. It's called curvature, the curvature of space. One of the things that modern theories of the way the universe was formed, that of a multiverse, predict is that the curvature of space is negative. That cannot be seen in the current data. The curvature is too small. The universe is too big. It's as if we're trying to see the curvature of the Earth by looking on a square centimeter of the ocean. But if the current theories are right, in particular the theory of what is called eternal inflation, that's a slightly different theory, and the idea of a multiverse and the idea of the universe being born out of a little bubble, then it makes a very clear prediction. The curvature of space should be negative. This data, what has been gotten over the last 3 years by Chow-Yin Kuo and this collaboration, adds a little bit of weight to the idea that we can detect the curvature of space. That would be huge. This experiment doesn't do it. But I think it adds to the fuel that we should go out and try to measure the curvature of space.
Again, Leonard Susskind with us from Stanford is professor of physics there, author of a new book called Quantum Mechanics. And Brian Green, professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia, author of The Hidden Reality and The Elegant Universe and co-founder of the World Science Festival, with us from New York. And, well, both you and Leonard are pretty much string theorists, I think, or often characterized and described. We've talked about string theory on this program with both of you. Brian, are we getting simply more verification of string theory and multiverses and all that?
I think that would be jumping the gun by a huge amount. I mean, I think first and foremost, what we really want to celebrate here are amazing observations. Those are the facts that they still need to be corroborated, but let's assume that it's all kosher. That's what's exciting. We've now seen real data, as Leonard and the other guests have been describing, that's allowing us to peer back to extraordinarily early moments in the history of the universe. I mean, really, what's going on here is, you know, if you take a piece of spandex and you stretch it, you can begin to see the weave that makes up the fabric. We are seeing the weave of space-time, in a sense. You're seeing these quantum ripples from the very early universe being stretched out and having an impact on things that we can observe. So it's so exciting to have real data. We theorists have been living in a period where there really isn't a lot of data for the more exotic theories that we're talking about. We found the Higgs boson, fantastic, but we expected that. That's been in the textbooks for 40 years. So to have a new piece of experimental data that is a real observational window into domains that bring gravity and quantum mechanics together, early universe physics, that's what's really exciting. But to now take the leap and try to use this as something that, you know, confirms string theory, that is jumping off the deep end.
Well, even this, to some extent, needs confirmation. I mean, we're going to have to wait for the Planck spacecraft.
For sure.
We've got the Planck spacecraft and about a dozen other teams and so forth moving forward. What does this open up, though, I mean, as you see it, in terms of what we understand about the beginning of time or time-space, for that matter?
Yeah, well, I guess what I'd say is this. You know, we've been talking about the inflationary theory, and as Lenny was indirectly noting, you know, the inflationary approach is really a paradigm. It's not a theory. It's not a unique theory per se. It's like democracy, right? Democracy is this paradigm of government, but it gets realized in many different ways in different countries around the world. Similarly, inflation is a paradigm that suggests that the universe underwent an incredibly rapid stretching in its earliest moments. But there are many ways of realizing that paradigm, many detailed theories that differ in the way they implement the paradigm. So what we can begin to do with the data is to winnow down the versions of the inflationary paradigm that are worth still considering. And that allows us to really hone in our equations and our ideas in order to have a much sharper understanding of the universe's earliest moments.
Don't we also understand from this that that tiny instant right after the Big Bang when the universe expanded explosively, it expanded faster than the speed of light?
Yeah, that's one way of describing it. If you look at the equations and their most straightforward, somewhat naive interpretation, you do have objects in space moving away faster from one another, faster than the speed of light. And sometimes when people hear that idea, they say, but wait, Einstein taught us that nothing goes faster than the speed of light. Einstein really taught us in special relativity that no object can move through space faster than the speed of light, but nothing in his ideas prevents objects from riding the swell of space itself, and in that way moving apart faster than the speed of light. And in the inflationary theory, that loophole, if you will, is made use of to great effect.
Talking with Brian Greene, who is professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University, and just a quick sense of a simile here that I'd like your response to, Brian. That is, someone was saying that these small expansions and contractions of space are like a wave traveling down a slinky.
That's not a bad way of looking at it. Whenever we talk about waves, whether they're electromagnetic waves or gravitational waves, we do imagine that kind of choreography where a piece goes up and a piece goes down and a piece goes up and so forth, like a water wave. So these gravitational waves, these ripples through the fabric of space-time, you can think about it with that mental image of a slinky. Key thing to bear in mind is these are incredibly tiny ripples, and at least in our current way of thinking about it, the only way they become visible is because the rapid swelling of space stretches them out and smears them across the sky where they can have an impact on other things like the microwave background radiation, which we can observe, as has been spectacularly done by the BICEP2 team.
I also like, I want to get this in here, a quote of Alan Guth's. He says the universe might be the ultimate free lunch.
Yep. Alan is famous.
I thought there was no free lunch. But
the idea there is that as space expands, you think that the amount of energy in it, in some sense, must go down because now you're spreading it out over a larger space. So the density, the concentration of the energy must go down. But remarkably, in the inflationary theory, as space expands, the more space there is, in some sense, the more energy there is, too. So it kind of is self-propelling. And in that way, it feels like a free lunch.
Well, let us hear from you, our listeners. This could be, if it stays on course, one of the greatest discoveries in the history of science, and we'd like to hear your thoughts about it. A team of astronomers released what's now being called a monumental discovery just this week about origins of the universe. They used telescopes at the South Pole, and scientists discovered gravitational waves that they say prove that the universe expanded rapidly, less than a trillionth of a second following the Big Bang. And scientists are calling the discovery smoking gun evidence of a theory known as inflation that has been, experts have been trying to prove for the last 35 years. We welcome your involvement in the program. If you have questions or comments, feel free to join us now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us toll-free at our toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. We talked earlier with Chao-Lin Kuo, one of the professors who was the part of the team that made this discovery. With us for the remainder of the hour, Andy Fracknoy here in studio, chair of the astronomy program at Foothill College, Leonard Susskind, who is Felix Bloch professor of physics at Stanford and author of Quantum Mechanics, and Brian Greene, professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia, author of The Hidden Reality and The Elegant Universe. This is Forum. I'm Michael Kresge. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the big announcement on Monday of a Big Bang breakthrough by scientists. We spoke with one of the scientists on the team, Chao-Lin Kuo, earlier, who is assistant physics professor at Stanford, part of the team that made the discovery of gravitational waves that really came right after the Big Bang. And We have kind of an all-star lineup here in studio. Andrew Fracknoy, chair of the astronomy program at Foothill College. Brian Green with us by phone, professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia and author of The Hidden Reality and the Elegant Universe. And Leonard Susskind, who is Felix Bloch professor of physics at Stanford and also author of The Black Hole War, The Cosmic Landscape, and a new book called Quantum Mechanics. Let me go right to your phone calls, and let's begin with John. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a somewhat tangential question, but I'm always curious. How long in today's time was the first trillionth of a second or half second or 1 second when the entire mass and universe are expanding? And what's the relationship to time?
Brian Green.
Yeah, well, you know, when you actually look at the equations, time is time. So we are really, in a sense, talking about the same kind of time that your wristwatch uses, even though the time scales are fantastically tiny.
But aren't they related to gravity and the density of the local?
Yeah, no. If you set things up correctly, smartly, then the time variable, the time coordinate, is something that actually plays the same role in the early universe as it does in the later universe.
Thank you for the question, John. We want to get as many of you on as we can. Let's go to Nicholas next. Nicholas, join us.
Hi. You just touched on something a minute ago about the conflict between Einstein's theory with speed of light limit and the point of the expansion rate being faster than that. I'm wondering if there's any theoretical work on that conflict, and that seems to be a pretty important thing to bring out.
Yeah, let's get a response from Professor Susskind. Leonard?
Yeah, well, I think Brian said it extremely well. Einstein said nothing can go faster than the speed of light. What he meant was nothing can go past you at faster than the speed of light. But if space is being swept away from you, if it's being swept away from you like the tide going out, then ripples on space very, very far away from you can appear to be going faster than the speed of light, just because the entire, as Brian calls it, the entire fabric of space is being swept along with the tide. And there's no conflict. Einstein completely understood that. All these ideas are, fundamentally, all of these ideas are based on Einstein's ideas. And no, there's no conflict about things very, very far away from you moving away from you faster than the speed of light. There would be a conflict if we saw a light ray going right by our nose faster than the speed of light.
Let me thank Nicholas for the call, and on we go to Boston. Michael, you're on. Hi.
Yes, hello. I was never much of a physicist, but about 20 years ago I did work on the graviton propagator in maximally symmetric manifolds like the Sitter space, the space for inflation, at least that was the model then. And I'm wondering whether the fluctuations that were seen in the data reflect basically fluctuations in the energy density in the early universe, or whether those are the sort of one-loop corrections that I used to look at.
Let me go back to you, Brian Green, if I may.
Yeah, I mean, we truly are talking about quantum processes that you can think of even just using the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which tells us that you can't ever have a wave which is completely flat and not moving. Then you'd know where it is and you know its speed. And Heisenberg told us a long time ago that you can't nail those two features at the same moment. So there's always a little jiggle, there's always a little jitter in all features in the universe. And when you apply that very idea to the fabric of space, which is the manifestation of gravity, space itself ripples. And we're talking about those little ripples being stretched out by the expansion and then having an observational impact that these tremendous experimenters have now observed.
And let me thank Michael for the call. You want to add something, Leonard Susskind?
Yeah, I just want to answer the question. The answer to the question is yes, they are the one-loop corrections that you studied.
And here's a tweet, Andy Fracknoy, from Chris, who says, help us understand the difficulty of this breakthrough achievement. What challenges had to be overcome to make the measurements?
Well, and I want to sort of step back and say that for those people who are listening and not quite following all the detailed science, what's really exciting here is that we're looking at an era of precise cosmology. Cosmology is the study of the entire universe. It's a mind-blowing part of astronomy where we study the properties of everything that exists. And for a long time, we could make general statements about the universe, theoretical statements, but now we're able to measure with amazing precision the characteristics of the universe down to, as the experimenter said at the beginning, one part in 30 million. So we are talking about an era of precise cosmology. To do this, you need machines to measure this afterglow of the Big Bang with unprecedented accuracy. And that's really part of the achievement of this group, that they have gone back to the energy left over from the Big Bang and teased out from it remarkably small effects. These little ripples that our guests have been speaking about are tiny compared to anything that you would measure in everyday life. Yet after years and years, they've teased out this effect of the inflation, the early blow-up of the universe.
Well, a follow-up question. A listener online named Sean says, how do you detect gravitational waves?
So we're detecting these waves by the imprint they left.
That's why they're like fossils.
That's right. It's very much it's like when you're finding something where you don't have the thing itself, but you find the imprint it left in the ground or in the geological record. Here there is this ancient geological record of the Big Bang, these waves of microwaves that are filling space all around us. And remarkably, inside this radiation, they have found even more ancient and even more precise records of the behavior of the universe.
And we go to more of your calls. Amer, you're on. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, with this new discovery, have we gotten any closer to understanding what caused the initial trigger to start the Big Bang?
Good question. Leonard Susskind.
Well, perhaps. As I said earlier, there's a little bit of glitch in the data. We don't, it doesn't exactly fit the standard pattern. That little bit of a glitch could have a hint in it of an earlier prehistory, but that's going to take a long time to sort out. That's not something that the data at the moment, is saying, yes, here is the way the universe was born. It's saying more that there are questions, that there are new questions. Look, every time a great discovery is made and answers some questions, it always raises new questions. The new question that's raised here is what came before inflation.
But I'm a little confused here, Leonard. Help me out. Isn't inflation supposed to erase all that preceded, so maybe we may never know what happened before inflation?
Good question. It depends on how long the inflation took place. How long did the inflation, by that means, here's what we know. We know that during this period, every 10 to the minus 35th seconds, every trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth seconds, the universe doubled in size. How long did that go on? The longer it went on, the more the early stuff is erased. If it didn't go on too long, then we have a small chance of being able to see back to the very onset of the inflation. Looking at the data, maybe with a little bit of optimism, you can say maybe there's some evidence that we can see back that early.
Let me thank the caller. I want to move on to another caller joining us from Alabama. Stephen, welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Thank you for having me. And this is a fascinating subject. I appreciate you guys covering it. My question is this. This is being touted as the smoking gun. And to me, what it really seems to be is showing that those who believe in a created universe are in line with what they're saying, because the Big Bang, if it happened in an undecillionth of a second, defies all known laws of physics and would ask the question, how did something defy the laws of physics and the universe come into existence in less than a blink of an eye? The Bible said that in the beginning, in Genesis. Why is there such a fight between the scientists who believe in this and the people who believe in a created universe? Why is there such a disparity when both believe that something happened instantaneously?
Well, who wants to wade into this? Go ahead, Andy Frankly.
Well, I'll start by saying that, in fact, it's almost the opposite of what you're suggesting. What we're now able to do is to look back further and further with physics. The remarkable achievement here is that we are taking the work of science and looking back to shorter and shorter and shorter times in the Big Bang itself. It's interesting to remember that when the Big Bang theory was first proposed, even the Pope loved it. There was an encyclical from the Pope at the time saying, gee, this sounds good to me. So the notion that there has to be a conflict between religion and what we understand about the universe from science, that's sometimes a whipped-up conflict that really isn't there in the minds of religious
people. It may be a red herring, in fact. And thanks, Stephen, for the call. I want to bring another caller on from New Mexico. Tony joins us. Good morning. You're on the forum.
Yes, thank you. These are amazing, precise measurements that are done on Earth and now. I'm wondering, how do you project back to then, with something as large as the universe and as small as an elementary particle, and talking about times which are trillions of femtoseconds, how do you determine the scale of what you are determining from these measurements?
Yeah, Brian Green.
It really relates to this question and the previous one, too. The power of having a mathematical framework and a physical understanding of the processes that math is describing means that you have a framework. And we can use that framework to, in some sense, wind the cosmic film back in time using the math, a rigorous approach, and therefore we can determine what must have happened early on to be responsible for what we see today. You just wind the film back. And the amazing thing is that there's this great agreement between what the math says that we should see today, based on what our physical theories say should have happened way back then, and what the experimenters actually do see. And that's the beauty of it all. And, you know, just to throw in one other thing that's sort of vital, you know, the Big Bang theory before inflation had a big puzzle, which was it wasn't at all clear what drove the outward swelling in the first place. One of the callers was saying, you know, what got things going? One of the big contributions of the inflationary theory is that it provides an answer to that. In Einstein's theory itself, it turns out that if space is filled with a certain kind of substance, which we believe now was there, it yields a kind of repulsive gravity, a kind of outward push that would have driven everything to rush apart. So now we can go deeper than we could before the inflationary theory by not just positing that space is expanding, but we now have a mathematical theory, a mechanism which tells us how fast it should have been expanding. And the observations confirm what the math is suggesting. That's the power of physics.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Let me go to some of your online comments. Kishore writes, great lineup. Excited to listen to this conversation. Hope Michael bones up on his math. And also says, can your guests address how this discovery may lead to confirmation of magnetic monopoles? Do we know what – I don't even know what that is. Brian or Leonard, can you help us out here?
No. One of the original points of inflation was to get rid of monopoles. Monopoles are little particles which are like the end of a magnet. They may or may not exist. They probably do exist as mathematical objects. They probably really do exist in the universe, but there are very, very few of them. And one of the original intentions of the inflationary theory was to understand why there were so few of them. And the answer is that the enormous inflation just spread them apart so much that that within our entire observable universe, there may be less than one of them. So this doesn't say anything new, really. It may change a little bit our guess about whether there are one monopole in the observable universe or 10 of them, but it's not going to change very much about monopoles.
Let me just read some more comments from listeners. Jennifer writes, a friend once quipped, there are four topics that should not be mentioned in polite company: sex, money, politics, and quantum mechanics. It's a pleasure to know that Forum can handle all of these. Thank you for that. A Facebook listener, Maureen, writes, Andy Fracknoid, wanting to know more about BICEP 2. What can you tell us that perhaps we should know about that telescope? Because that's really the key here, isn't it?
Well, so BICEP 2, they went to the South Pole, and they built a series of detectors, instruments which are like telescopes and digital camera, in a sense. And when you take a picture, you'd record that.
It's like the two combined, yeah.
That's like the two combined. And what they've done is they've put together hundreds of these very sensitive instruments so they could detect this extremely faint radiation much better than has ever been possible to do and tease out, as we've heard so many times now, tease out this very faint signal that's left over from inflation.
And here's Robert, who writes online, and I hope the journalists will stop using the word proof and prove when reporting news such as this. Using these words damages science and science education. How much effort will it take to explain that proofs are objects of mathematics, not objects of scientific inquiry? As well as a layperson like me understands this announcement, it's a report that the observations are strongly consistent with those predicted using Goose mechanism, providing clear and convincing evidence, he puts that in big type, that his explanation of the very early universe is correct. This is very impressive news. These observations aren't proof of anything. All right. Another kind of critical comment online. Frank writes, more Big Bang nonsense. Cosmologists too often want to turn their observational, non-experimental science into a pseudo-religion with a definite design starting date and presumably ending date and always the possibility of a creator. There is no rational reason to buy into this. I would accept that perhaps there was a local Big Bang, but there is no scientific reason to think that beyond the limits of our telescopes, there was not always an infinite expanse of space, and that in that expanse, other Big Bangs have happened at other times, stretching back forever. We should see the effort to prove expansion of the local part of the universe for what it is, wishful thinking by humans who are trying to inject irrational religious gobbledygook into science are just as bad to personally stand out to boost their careers. Whoa, Brian Green, we're talking a lot about proof here and kind of taking shots at...
Well, I mean, the proof comment, the first writer, sure. I mean, what science does is it builds a case for an idea by doing observations, experiments, and as they agree with your predictions, your confidence in an idea grows and it grows and it grows. And you never do prove it. It could be a million experiments that confirm an idea and then the million infer. Somehow an anomaly happens and you're forced to change your ideas. So I agree with that. This other one, though, is this strange mixture of ideas, some of which hold water and some of which are just bizarre. Again, the key thing is these are not wild speculations that physicists dream up at night in some kind of delusional state. These are rigorous mathematical explorations that make predictions. And then you go out and you test the predictions, and when there's an agreement, your confidence in the ideas grows.
Let me follow that up, Brian, with another question from a listener who writes, if the universe started as a rapid expansion from a single point, and we are looking at the remnants of that expansion, can we tell where the center point, in other words, the point of origin of the expanding universe is? It seems like that would be a very interesting spot to study.
Yeah, we can. It's right where the caller is sitting. It's where you're sitting. It's where I'm sitting. Because all of these points in the observable universe that are now distinct points, they were closer and closer together in the earliest moments of the universe, and in some sense they were the same point in the very beginning. Again, I need to emphasize, we still don't know the very beginning. We still don't have a full mathematical understanding of the true origin of it all. But putting that to the side, pushing our equations back to a tiny fraction of a second after a beginning, that's what they tell us. All these distinct points were on top of each other, and in a sense, they were the same point.
Andrew Fracknell, you had a point.
So I wanted to add something to set the background a little bit. One of the things that a lot of people get mixed up about when they think about cosmology is they imagine that there was an empty space at the beginning, and the Big Bang exploded into that, like the explosion of a building or something like that. And that's not how we view the Big Bang. Interestingly, and sometimes mind-bogglingly, the Einstein view of the Big Bang is that the Big Bang was not an explosion in space, but an explosion of space. Space, time, matter, and energy all begin in the Big Bang. So the Big Bang is space and time expanding at the same time that matter and energy expand. That's a very mind-scrambling idea, but it also helps to understand Brian's wonderful point about the idea that we are not in any special place. Every one of us stands where the Big Bang began, every point in the universe.
But I remember Hawking got all, changing his view of creation and God and went from being an agnostic to an atheist when he discovered that the Big Bang may have been preceded by gravity.
Well, there are lots of thoughts and theories about what the early universe before was like. I always love the old quote from St. Augustine, who was asked by one of his acolytes what God was doing before God created the heavens and the earth. And he thought about it for a moment and said, "My son, he was making hell for people who ask questions like that."
Here's a listener, Leonard Susskind, who says, "Gravity can be joined with quantum mechanics, but it requires people to give up the notion of space-time as causality rather than a useful mathematical representation."
Was there a question there? I didn't think
well, there. I think it's more of a statement. You want to respond, though?
I didn't understand it.
I think he's suggesting that causality is really not necessarily a part of what we can divine here. I'll use that word advisedly.
I don't... okay.
All right, we'll move on, actually, because I've got another question that about Einstein's theory of space's curve from Jack and Davis. Hi, Jack.
I saw a film a long time ago and said that Einstein realized that space was curved by watching water run down a stream. I saw that the water didn't flow in a straight line, but it curved as it moved down the stream. And so my question is it possible that we're not living in a puddle or a lake in which the ripples, when you drop a rock in a lake, the ripples move equal distance away from the puddle, but that we're actually moving in a stream, and that the drop in the stream actually goes with the stream or against the stream. So that what I'm asking is that is it possible that we are actually living in a current rather than and something like the universe is in an eddy that is circling upon itself, similar to a stream.
We'll go to one of the physicists here, Brian Green or Leonard Susskind.
I'll let Lenny take that one.
Thank you, Brian. Yes, it's possible. Look, time is a stream. Time is a stream. It goes forward. We sail down time. I don't think the analogy of living in a stream, literally living in a stream, is a good analogy for cosmology. I think a better analogy may be something like living on the surface of an expanding balloon. We're swept along by the expansion, but there's no sense in which I can see in which we're floating down a river. We're perhaps living on an expanding ocean. The ocean expanding now, today, the expansion is very slow. Early on, the expansion was very fast. It's a very interesting question about why the rate of expansion changed so much. As I said, early on, the universe doubled in size every 10 to the minus 35 seconds, every trillionth of a trillionth of a trillion seconds. Today, the universe is doubling every 10 or 20 billion years. In each case, the universe is doubling, it's inflating, it's growing, but something happened in between that slowed the rate of inflation tremendously. And in some sense, I suppose, it's like living in a very fast stream in the beginning and then flowing out into an ocean or flowing out into a much bigger body of water that's expanding much more slowly.
Let me thank the caller, and we'll try to get more of your calls on. In fact, let me go to a caller in Berkeley. Richard, you're on. Good morning.
Hello, yes. Two questions. Firstly, could you explain a little bit more how gravity and gravity waves are predicted by inflationary theory? And secondly, I wanted to ask, do the laws of physics predate the Big Bang? How do they come into existence before matter? How do the fundamental laws of nature coincide with the expansion of the Big Bang?
Yeah, we'll go to you on these, Brian.
Yeah, so it's not so much that inflation itself predicts gravitational waves. It's that inflation, when combined with quantum theory, says that these quantum ripples that quantum mechanics, when applied to gravity, implies would be there, that inflation then stretches those out in a way that makes them observable, potentially observable, and now perhaps actually observed. As for the second question, I guess it was, do the laws of physics predate the Big Bang? That's a deep question, and it's hard to know even exactly what it means. Perhaps one way of thinking about it is maybe the universe and its laws all come into existence together, or perhaps the notion of before the Big Bang is a concept that may not even make sense. I mean, it makes sense to think about before today, before the day before yesterday, and so forth. But maybe the notion of before doesn't apply when it comes to the Big Bang. Maybe time itself came into existence there, too. So these are all highly speculative, interesting physics and philosophical questions that we just can't answer yet.
Well, I don't know if you can answer this one either, Brian Green, but Ken writes, great show, really enjoy this discussion, even though I don't understand any of it. But my question is this, how can you know your measurements are precise? I'm a field surveyor, and we can't rely on GPS elevation or horizontal readings for measurements taken inside a city boundary. Are you sure?
Yeah, that's usually above my pay grade. So I play with equations on paper, and it's these heroic physicists who actually go out and make these observations, do these experiments. I stand in awe of them, too, that they're able to measure these tiny, tiny effects with fantastic precision and with great confidence.
And here's a tweet. Listener Raya tweets to us, since there is almost no practical application for this now or in the future, in my humble opinion, this is purely an academic exercise. Andy Fragner shaking his head vigorously. No.
No, I think quite the opposite. I think what we're looking at here are the fundamental rules of the universe. Every time we have looked at these fundamental rules of how the universe works, all kinds of amazing applications have come. GPS was just mentioned, which needs relativity to actually give you the precise location where you are on Earth. As we uncover these rules and these behaviors about the universe, amazing things may flow from them. We may not have an immediate gadget tomorrow, but every time we have made discoveries like this, wonderful things have come from them.
Well, wonderful things have come from this hour. I want to thank all of our guests and our callers and you, our listeners. And let me actually ask you, Andy Fragner, you got an evening class on Einstein, and you're going to be teaching some stuff spring quarter?
Right. So at Foothill College here in the Bay Area, if people are interested, we are doing a course called Physics 12, which sets all this background. What was the theory of relativity? What is quantum mechanics that we've been talking about? And we invite members of the public to come down to Foothill and check it out.
And thank you for coming here and being with us in studio. Thanks also to Brian Green, who is with us by phone from New York, professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia, author of The Hidden Reality and The Elegant Universe, and co-founder of the World Science Festival and World Science U. Brian, good to have you.
Pleasure.
And Leonard Susskind, thank you for being with us. Felix Bloch, professor of physics at Stanford, author of Quantum Mechanics, a new book, and also author of The Black Hole War and the Cosmic Landscape. Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you, Michael.
And thank you to Chao Lin Kuo, who joined us earlier, part of the team that made the discovery, assistant physics professor of Stanford. Another hour up ahead, we're going to talk about the history of the Jews with Simon Shama. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.